Welcome to Holden Village. Today is July the 23rd, 1999, and in Fireside this evening, the forum is called A Discussion of the World Council of Churches Jubilee 2000 Campaign, number 99-10. Let's listen in.
My name is Jim Martin Schramm. I'm one of the summer teaching staff coordinators, along with my wife Karen and Dan Spencer, who just left this morning for a couple days to get a little R&R. Kind of weird to think you have to leave Holden to get some R&R. But
oh, it's very real.
That's right. Yes, it is. After you're here for a while. How many of you have been here all week? Have you all been here all week? Okay, so were you here for Jubilee, for the Jubilee celebration? Okay. Was it Wednesday, Tom? We had the Jubilee, the Festival of Jubilee, which is a tradition out of the book of Leviticus, chapter 25. In the 50th year, well, you know, you're supposed to, every 7 years, let the land lay fallow, and then every 50 years, debts would be forgiven, land would be returned to its original owner. It was a way, at least theoretically, for the ancient Israelites to practice or to right economic wrongs, to prevent the concentration of wealth in the hands of the poor. And of course, in an agrarian society, that meant land. And so every 50 years, the land would be redistributed back to the original landowner. So this Wednesday we celebrated Jubilee because it represents a symbol of a Christian commitment to economic justice. Now, the forum tonight is on the notion of forgiving the debt of poor nations. And the reason we're talking about it is because there's a campaign, an international campaign called Jubilee 2000, which is calling on nation states and the big multilateral lending institutions, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, to forgive the debt of the most heavily indebted and poorest countries, I should say. Forgive the debt of the poorest countries. The United States is the most heavily indebted. $5 trillion debt, I believe it is at this point. There's been a lot of pressure over the last couple of years, and as we near the end of this century, as we enter the new millennium, there are a lot of religious communities, including the ELCA, who have joined together urging the United States and other countries, along with these multilateral lending institutions, to forgive the debt of the poorest countries of the world. Now, in order to have a conversation about it, we weren't sure how many folks were kind of up to speed on this whole issue. Some of you may be here precisely because you are really up to speed on it. But Dan and I, when we were thinking about how to stoke the fire for this big conversation, decided that we would ask four people to argue four different positions that one might take in relationship to this challenge for debt forgiveness. And so I've asked Ed and Tom and Jake and Ann to each kind of represent a view, not a view they necessarily hold, but to represent a view for a minute, get those out there to interact with each other to the extent they want to, and to use that as a way to sort of break the ice and get us into the conversation. So why don't I begin? I think Ed's going to start, followed by Ann, and then Tom, and then Jake. At least that was the order that we talked about earlier. So let's go ahead. I'm going to put this door.
Well, it's nice to talk about all these religious concepts, but you know, this is really a political problem, and I was told never to talk about politics, sex, and it was one other thing, and I always seem to forget what that was, but what the heck. You know, I went to college and took on all this debt to get through school. I had to borrow money. I even had to put up my furniture as collateral, and I was late in my payment. They wanted to take my grandmother's sewing machine away just for collateral. Boy, talk about forgiven debts. They sure didn't do that with us. Now, I've got all those liberal politicians back there in Washington, and they're giving money off to all these countries so they can buy their support. And who's getting the money? More politicians, more corrupt governments, the rich people that are already there. So how are we going to help the people by declaring the forgiveness of this debt? They're not getting it now. Why do we think they're going to get it then? You see them driving Mercedes and having yachts and palatial mansions. We can't afford them. We got $1 trillion debt. It's just, you know, it's unreal, the amount of taxes and stuff, and now they want to tell us to take on more. If we're talking about forgiving, why don't they forgive our debt? You know, all the people that hold this money. And just stop loaning money around the world, trying to help everybody take on the form of government we have, when that's probably not what they need in their country anyway. Let them have the freedom of choice. These comments are not necessarily the opinions of the management.
Well, I'm Monsignor's sister, Anne. Probably the only time in my life I'll be the representative from the Holy Roman Catholic Church. Mm. So I'm pleased to talk about the Catholic principle, which I think is rooted in the sacredness of all life, and the broad sacramental understanding of life, which is that God's grace and forgiveness operates through all of life. And I can't agree with my colleague across the room about this drastic separation of church and state, because I think as a Roman Catholic, we understand that God's grace is operative in all of life. So that's rooted in the sacramental notion, which is fundamentally theological, and in another theological principle, which we have celebrated, and I've been delighted to be a Roman Catholic at a Lutheran institution up here for the week and see that. You have celebrated another theological theme of the Roman Church, which is the notion that since God rules over all of life, we also understand the ministry of Jesus, which talks about forgiving our debts as we forgive the debts of others. The Holy Papal Office also wants to remind us that some key points about our position. One is the face value of these loans have been paid off many times. What is problematic for these countries is the unbelievable amount of interest that's just burying these countries in debt. There is more money flowing from poor nations to rich nations in debt payments than there is in financial aid and development assistance from rich nations to poor nations. And that's a rather interesting fact. And finally, in many cases, it was wealthy elites who borrowed these funds initially and deposited them in Geneva bank accounts, but now it's the poor step paying with the bill, and I think many of us can understand that. So as we look at arriving at the millennium and we look ahead, it seems that the position of the Roman Catholic Church is one of profound forgiveness for these countries, based not on partiality, since understanding is that God shows no partialness to those who need forgiveness, and that we allow forgiveness to down in these countries. And that is the position of the management of this.
That is the position of the management, yeah.
I'm representing the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in this discussion, and I... And we've had a lot of experience, decades of experience in this arena of seeing countries borrow money and also countries get themselves out of debt. And so I think I'm going to take the middle road between these two positions. I mean, first of all, to say that people do need to take responsibility for their actions, and debts, things that are borrowed, should be paid back. But the fact of the matter is that some of these poorer countries, their debt now is so large that it's impossible for them to pay it back, and it will not be paid back. It just simply will not be paid back. That's the reality. Interest, as you're saying, interest payments alone are staggering. So there has to be some sort of solution besides just saying that people should pay back what they borrowed. There has to be some sort of solution. And what's the sad thing, that's what's happening, is now as people are putting all their money, as these countries are putting all their money into paying the interest on their debt, it's prohibiting economic growth of those countries. So they just continue to keep getting mired in slow-moving economies. And that's really what needs to be solved, is to increase economic growth in these countries. And even though some of this debt was originally incurred because these countries wanted to get their economies going, now the interest payments are really a barrier to economic growth. So what the IMF and the World Bank would suggest is not simply forgiving all these debts, but making some conditions so that people just don't get themselves in the same kind of problem. To tie some strings to these, the forgiveness of debts. So in other words, you might say countries with high debt burdens over the next years would have all or some of their debt forgiven if they followed some plans that would help them and their economies grow. And some call this structural adjustment plan, some call this short-term pain, long-term gain. But if you look at a lot of countries in the Pacific Rim, you will see the success of these measures that in order for these countries to really make it, they're going to have to take on some economic reforms. So we'll forgive their debt, but in exchange, what they need to do is reduce some of their public food subsidies, some of the tremendous costs that these countries are paying for health and education. They need to tighten their belts. They also need to open up their domestic markets to international trade, and they also need to let private corporations come in and invest in those countries and also have the profits be available to these international private companies. If those things are done, the IMF and the World Bank can see that some or all of this debt can be forgiven if we get these countries on the right road to economic growth, because that in the end is what's going to save us if there is economic growth in these countries and we can get them out of the mess that we're in. But straight debt forgiveness without some kind of economic reforms will solve nothing.
Well, I'm going to claim the middle ground. I think between Tom and Anne, which is the concept of jubilee is exceedingly important, and we need to pay close attention to its theological underpinning, and not try to use just the kind of economic sense that's obviously driving a lot of countries into serious debt. There's a lot of powerful biblical precedent for this kind of debt forgiveness. Unfortunately, turning the tables on debt isn't going to reverse the trends necessarily. It's not something that is just either or. Debt is bad, so we get rid of it, now everything's good. Time has passed, you can't really just reverse trends. I mean, you have to take into account the cumulative effects. And so to simply say we should just get rid of all the debt, I think is going to cause serious problems, and in particular in economic stability. And that's where I think there's some good points that the IMF has. But this whole thing about sort of rampant economic growth being the way to salvation, I mean, that we can see in the biblical precedent in the Torah. So I would suggest that, in fact, we just look at this on a very individual basis, case by case, country by country. What do these countries really need? What is it that they don't need? Can they handle the kind of economic growth that the World Bank would like to see them take on? are they capable of paying some of it back? Are the governments corrupt in such a way that would prevent that any kind of economic stability from being able to be maintained in the event of debt forgiveness? I think this is a far more complex issue, and to just make some sweeping changes for the sake of the numbers rolling over is a serious mistake.
Okay. Well, thanks. That's an attempt, at least, to put four positions out there. One is, you know, people with debt should play by the rules and pay back their debt. Another is to forgive some debt with strings attached, the structural Tom's structural adjustment approach. The Anne's Holy See approach, it's time to forgive the debt of all nations, all poor nations. And then debt should be forgiven, but on a case-by-case basis. Yep. Some of you may have a lot of international experience. You may have a lot of knowledge about a particular country and its debt situation. You're here because you're interested in the issue, apparently. What is it that brings you here this evening? What experience in your life has made you sensitive to the issue of debt of poor nations? Where would you like to begin this discussion, either in reaction to the four positions you just heard or in relationship to your own experience and interests?
Well, the reason I'm here is that I would like to be informed or feel, I think just in the economic systems that the world works under, mm-hmm. I know when I was in school I was really interested in socialism. I read Michael Harrington's book but that seems to just have gone on. Even the Democratic Party today is very free market. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at what's going to be the best for the people of the countries, and I just don't understand. It gets so complicated. I just don't know which approach is best. I mean, Tom's approach seems to make sense, but then you know the idea that maybe just free. I mean, but what's you know how corrupt are some of these countries' systems, mm-hmm. and how best can we help the people of these countries? Mm-hmm. That's kind of why I'm here. Mm-hmm.
Use the debt forgiveness as leverage to get political change, either democratic change or...
I mean, I've heard of these draconian changes in countries like in South America and in mm-hmm. the Pacific Rim to get the IMF has this, you know, just... But yet the people, the average people are being just squished. They're right. Just being abused in terms of economically, and I don't know if that has to happen or does it have to happen. That's why.
Well, yeah. I mean, in these structural adjustment programs, one of the things they call for.
Jack interest rates way up.
Well, one of the things they call for is the elimination of public subsidies of various things, whether it be food like tortillas in Mexico, or health care, or education. Those things are seen to be unproductive. They're not good expenditures, public expenditures. These subsidies aren't. And so some of the structural adjustment programs have required nations to pull back. And so, you know, the reason they're subsidizing is because people are poor and can't afford it. And so when they pull the subsidy back, it makes it more expensive for the poor. And so you're exactly right. They get squished. Disproportionate to the middle, whatever middle class exists.
So I just don't get it. I don't get it. Is that necessary? Is there a better way? And I don't really know politically for my congressman, I don't really know what the Christian perspective is, mm-hmm. what the best approach is. So
yeah. Well, how about the rest of you? Do you want to reply to David? Do you have?
Well, I don't think there is any right way.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think first off, we're going to have to educate some of these countries, because if we forgave all the debt that these mm-hmm. debtor nations have, mm-hmm. that wouldn't solve any problem. It would solve the problem because in a few years, you'd have the same situation reoccur. So then you're just got to continue perpetual.
Assuming people are willing to loan them more money.
Well, yes, but I think first off, we're going to have to educate the people. And I think we're going to have to do something more about curbing some of the population growth in these very, very poor countries. Because if we don't curb the population growth, you can't solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's population stuff is actually the sort of area of ethics that I teach ethics at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and my research field has been ethics and population policy. And in 1974, the UN has these big meetings on population in every 10 years. So in 74, 84, 94. 74, nations like the US came to Bucharest and said, you know, we got a population explosion, we got to deal with it right now. And folks from India and other developing nations, especially Africa, said, no, you're not going to jam condoms, you know, at us. Development is the best contraceptive. That's what brought your fertility rates down. So what we want is international assistance. 10 years later, it was actually very different. The U.S. came and said, it was the Reagan administration, and they were really ratcheting down U.S. support for population stuff. But by 1984, a lot of nations in Africa were seeing all of their efforts at development, economic development in particular, but also social development, education, health, being diminished because there were simply that many more people in those countries because of rapid rates of population growth. So by 1984, the developing nations came to Mexico City saying, we're ready to talk Turkey, and then you have the U.S. kind of backing away. And then in 1994, they came back together again. So anyway, that's a digression, but you're right. I mean, it does matter. That aspect really does matter. To my knowledge, that debt forgiveness hasn't been tied to family planning or anything like that. No one's making that argument that I know of, which is frankly probably wise.
But I think they're going to have to be tied.
Yeah.
So it's
Well, of course, the argument has been that economic, you know, investment, economic growth will reduce fertility over time. But in the short term, that's the problem. What other reactions do you have? Where do you want to get into this conversation?
I've been looking at these issues for quite a while. I have a master's degree in international economics.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned the World Bank model very well. And the first year, anyway, and the second year I was in this program, I didn't buy it. You know, there's too many problems with it. And one thing, without getting into all of the microeconomics of it all, one thing that I personally reject is this notion that we need, like you said, I'm sorry, but I don't think we are in a position to say we can educate everybody. We have the idea, the package that we are exporting to the world is called the Washington Consensus right now, and the IMF is applying that. But, you know, who are we in a free society, and probably somewhere in Scripture has something to say about this too, who are we to prescribe using debt as a leverage, social change in a lot of these countries?
I think Ed should have a reply at this point.
Well, I was thinking a few minutes ago about this forgiving of debt, and it bothered me that I'm not holding a promissory note from anyone in any other country, but there are institutions that are, and we're asking them to forgive that debt. What are they going to do? They're going to turn around and say they need government support. So indirectly, they're not forgiving debt. They're telling us to take on additional burden to help reduce the debt somewhere else. Now, that didn't address your question, I know, but you know, that's what politicians do.
Yeah.
Can we take this political line a little?
Yeah.
Your original, one of your original comments, Ed, was that this is a political issue,
not an
economics issue. And I got especially interested. I've been sort of following the debt issue for years and years, but got more closely impacted by it living 2 years in Nicaragua. And let's take this political, just to draw that argument out further, and I don't know, if maybe it's not what's meant by that stance, but let's take Nicaragua. The debt over the last 5 years has been cut in half. And if you compare the situation today to the early 90s, less money is being spent on education, less money is being spent on health care. I'd say the condition of most of the people that I work with is probably worse off today
than it was when I first met them 5 years ago. So what did forgiveness get us? You know, sort of taking, picking up your line.
Well, I think we're punishing the wrong people, you know, with this debt. You're talking about it being a burden on all of these people that their countries can't recover because they're saddled with this debt. But is that debt the people, or is it the people that we tried to support in office who have all these Swiss bank accounts and money out of the country? Why aren't they paying back the debt? Why aren't we after them instead of telling us to forgive and pushing it back, ignoring the culprits, and then saying, oh, we've got to, you know, re-educate the people, really, so they can learn and can do better. It ain't the people.
Of course, someone say the culprits are sitting there in that big building in
D.C. As the World Bank, yeah.
Sort of engineered some of this, you know, they're those, indirectly
those
20 years
money-hungry people. The only reason they're loaning any isn't for social justice. They're after the profit that comes back. Yeah, boy.
Well, the mandate of the World Bank is to bring development aid to the poorest countries of the world.
Isn't that in your constitution?
Yeah. Well, you know, what do you mean talking about them giving money to the poorest countries? You know, they spend billions of dollars for airplane purchases, loaning money to these countries that want to each have their own airplane fleet. How many nations have to have a charter airline? Every country in Africa have to have an airline of their own, so IMF loans money so they can buy from Boeing, or, you know, what kind of a deal are you talking about?
Well, that's
helps the... Helps you guys out in Seattle.
Well, that's right. This is the issue that Jake's perspective or position is trying to offer is let's continue to offer assistance and, you know, let's take the World Bank and the IMF and reform them, but to change their approach to economic development away from these sort of big infrastructure projects where you pay for all these gigantic Boeing 727s or 7 whatever they are, and then these big deep ocean ports, and instead direct the money at the poorest of the poor, spend the money on healthcare, spend the money on education, invest in the people rather than in the economic infrastructure. But that's a very different approach to economic development than has normally been conceived as appropriate. And yet that's what a lot of folks are trying to encourage the World Bank to do as they consider forgiving debt of some of these. There are about 40 nations that have very high debt loads, and about 75% of those are in Africa. I think they're talking about a little over $200 billion that's owed to either multilateral lending institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, or to individual countries, or to private banks. But the banks have figured this out a long time ago, because the debts have been non-performing. That is to say, the countries haven't been paying. And so, you know, what do they do when they get a debt that isn't performing? Over time, they write it off as a loss. And they pass the loss on to their shareholders, but they move on.
Yeah, but they don't forgive the debt.
No, but they write it off.
Often someone else buys it, so someone else might still be holding that debt.
That's true, but they buy it at less than its face value.
And sometimes the countries themselves buy it back.
Yeah.
The World Bank and IMF have loaned money to several countries to buy back their own debt.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty loaded language, the forgiveness stuff, though, because trying to argue from the perspective that I actually wish I knew more about, but that... I mean, this language is all mixed up, and I think that's part of the difficulty, is that it is socially and economically and political and religious. And when you talk about forgiving debt, all of these have some theological merit in the tradition as well, so it's you can begin to see the difficulty of trying to come up with even a Christian position, let alone...
that's exactly right. One of the little pieces I had written for Ed was, forgiveness is a theological concept, not an economic concept. Luther warned us not to try to run the world with the gospel of grace and mercy, but rather to use law to govern the affairs of this world and mercy to govern the affairs of the church. you know, classic two kingdoms kind of stuff. And I haven't heard anyone make that argument yet, but some good conservative Lutheran might trot that one out every now and then. Don't run the world with the gospel.
You know, though, if the churches wanted to, you know, set the example, then most of the churches should get rid of a lot of the wealth that they have in their brick and mortars and, you know, disperse those funds. And then
we could pay off their debt.
They would be leading by example, but they really don't do that. Mm-hmm. Churches, you know, all churches, they're guilty. Mm-hmm. As anyone. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the churches pay no taxes on a lot of the properties that they own. And if you look at some of the properties that they own, like in Illinois, for instance, I'm not picking on the Catholic Church, but the Catholic Church owns lots of land. Mm-hmm. And take the Mormons in Utah. They own half of Utah. Mm-hmm. So there's enough wealth there that the churches have that they could set a great example. Mm-hmm. But the question is, why not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's, yes.
This idea of debt forgiveness and being unable, that because of this country being unable to pay their debt, I think should be looked from the idea of why these countries are unable to pay their debt. Mm-hmm. There must be some reason. I mean, you can't just say, no, I'm not able to pay the debt. Why? And I'm afraid there are some kind of similarities, reasons from these countries that are unable to pay their debt. Now, the difficulties they're having, if the difficulties of the basis of not paying their debt. I'm just wondering if there is somebody who has some idea why these countries are unable to pay their debt.
I think, I mean, I don't know, I can't make a blanket statement, but you have to look at each.
There's several things, so go ahead and just identify them.
I mean, you have to look at each individual country, like you said over here. Some countries took out loans, but first of all, I should say that most of the loans have to go to approved projects, mm-hmm. coming from the World Bank, and the IMF then has a number of countries approve these projects too. So they do come with strings attached to them. So I think you have to take a look at each individual country, and there's different things countries can do than they have done. For example, Bolivia at one time devalued their currency so much that they had 40,000% inflation, you know, hyperinflation. So then you pay back your loan in worthless currency. Mm-hmm. Well, that's one way to do it, but then who is affected by that? Mm-hmm.
Well, see, and normally the loans are taken in dollars, and they have to be paid in dollars, and so Then you try to trade your Bolivian currency on the market to get dollars. Forget about it.
Yeah, so I think it's a very complicated issue, and it might be better to take a look at just one country in case.
Yeah.
But I think you could make some blanket statements. I mean, that I think you could attack the position that I was arguing on the basis of just look at these countries who have already agreed to structural adjustment. Look at the countries that have agreed to the strings attached, and look what's happened to them. It's not worked.
Yeah.
And there are very few examples where it's worked, and in most examples, it's put these countries into more debt. Right. And so at some point,
Indonesia.
Have to reject the strings.
Even Chile, which is often held up as the prime example by the World Bank, has retained more controls over currency, for example, than the World Bank prescribes and forces on other countries in their structural adjustment program. So yeah, you're right.
One of the arguments that I find persuasive, or at least hard to dismiss, is the argument of some developing nations, maybe Korea, South Korea, for example, that would say, well, you know, we paid our debts back. We got a bunch of loans, and it took us a long time. We saved our money. We paid them back. I'm trying to think of another good example. I'm not sure there are that many. But you know what I mean. I mean, maybe Zimbabwe did. I don't know. But to try to find, I mean, there are some nations that aren't the poorest of the poor that have had loans and they have paid them back. And then all of a sudden, not all, well, I mean, at the end of this century, to have the debt forgiven of 40 nations, how would you feel? And it raises some questions of justice, fundamental fairness. Now, you know, from a Christian perspective, the preferential option for the poor means you give preference to the poorest of the poor. But that, everybody else in the world shares those values and those commitments. And it's a pretty tough sell politically for
well, can't
those
you just
countries.
Say what Susan said on Wednesday morning? I mean, tornado! Tornado, everyone's going to have a lot more fun if we just let it go and start over.
Well, it does seem to me that the maintaining the debt certainly isn't doing anybody any good. I mean, it's just keeping these countries mired in poverty, and then they can't buy goods or, you know, they can't trade very well. They don't have the resources to engage in international trade. It's certainly not going to help the quality of life for their people. So it just seems that on just common sense, there should be a point where we could agree that enough is enough. I mean,
so what should the Christian position be? Is it it's debt forgiveness? Do we just that's the
well, I think
that's what we're called to do, or is it more as Jake was articulating that it's a case by case situation? And I mean, if I look at Nicaragua, if the debt is forgiven, which it should be, has to be, needs to be, the condition of it well could be that the condition of the majority of people will not change for the better. Mm-hmm. I think that is an absolutely necessary condition for the people of Nicaragua to have hope.
Right.
But the forgiveness of the debt in and of itself will not necessarily change things in their daily lives.
So what kind of strength would?
That's a you know, we could sit here and talk about you know, what should there be political strings attached to debt forgiveness.
I'm from the old school. You know, I believe that if people want to put forth a concept like this, let them put their money where their mouth is. We got all of these politicians that are multimillionaires. We got churches with vast holdings that could command a lot of money on the open market. What are they doing? They're telling us we have to forgive. Hey, let's look at some of the other side of this coin.
Are you being Ed, or are you being your physician?
That's for you to figure out.
I was thinking the same thing.
Good actor never gives away.
I think that in terms of this, the kind of position I articulated, the real flaw is that it's masquerading as jubilee, but it's not. There's two things going on simultaneously. I think there's a sudden, it's not really sudden, but there's a wake up that this debt isn't working for the people who want to make it work, and that includes the people who are lending the money. And this is an economic and political thing going on. But there's also, that isn't debt forgiveness at all. Like, the case-by-case basis, the strings attached, the leveraging, we need to do something about you people over there, that has nothing to do with Jubilee. It just happens, I think, to be coming up simultaneously. The Jubilee concept is Jubilee 2000 is an international movement that started from the grassroots. It's a crazy concept. Somebody in grassroots beginnings is getting up to the level of the IMF. There's a bill in Congress But this is an international movement talking about what it means to really start over again in a community sense, in a world community sense, not us and them and us helping them or. It's a totally different concept, and I think the problem is that all these other positions are masquerading as Jubilee positions, but they're not the same thing.
So you're saying that pure Jubilee is
tornado, start over again.
Yeah, but you know, and you know the problem, right? I mean, there's no evidence that ancient Israel ever did it. So then we get back to the question of, you know, is it. Yes, we can have the pure Jubilee, but if no one's really applied it, is it such a? I mean, it's more of a symbol than it is an effective.
If it's about purity exactly, but more about paying attention to thinking that our Christian position can be based on the most economically savvy of these principles, especially when it comes to places like the World Bank. That's great if that's what we end up with. If that's how politics works out, super. But I don't know if that can be. What we call based on our Jubilee.
Yeah, it probably isn't a sufficient motive. I mean, the motive of religious communities is rooted in mercy, as opposed to in, you know, performing debt or non-performing debt or not. Yeah.
It's an extremely complex issue, obviously. I think Jubilee never came about because there was good common sense in the world not to let it happen. It'd just be a license for greed to run rampant, in my mind.
Has it not run rampant?
Tom thinks greed has had its day.
I'm just leading into that. Okay.
is that Tom or is that an ass?
Which is that? And let's face it, the economics of the world are tied together nowadays. It's not just an isolationist policy. If you removed everything right away, I think the little episodes that Japan has just had, or the episodes we had with savings and loans a few years ago, would be probably something worth considering how it affects us all. And maybe it should affect us that way. But, you know, if the Catholic Church gave back the gold that they took from Central America on the backs of the people there, it probably solved all the problems. That churches have created massive problems along with everybody else. And corrupt leaders that, hey, the World Bank may have some strings tied, and they're better at tying strings now than they were initially. But let's face it, most of that has gone to corruption rather than going to the people themselves. And when you look at grassroots things, where service groups and churches and Mormons are very effective at this as compared to the rest of us, of getting out, working with the people and helping the people, seems to do much, much better than going with the corrupt organizations. But I still believe we're the ugly Americans. I don't think we know how to approach the foreign countries. I think we think that our democracy is good for everybody, and it's not. We try to solve everybody's problems from our perspectives rather than looking at their perspectives. And I think if we're going to solve the problem, it has to be case by case, looking at their perspectives first, how they got there, and then what can we do to assist it. It'd just be irresponsible to say they'll erase it all. And before I came in, a good friend who's a retired judge that didn't want to come in said, would it be any different than us saying, let's commute the sentences of everybody that's in jail right now and set them free? Or the debts of all the courts and just let them.
But of course the difference is, you know, for a criminal, they've been individually tried and found guilty. The problem in this case is you have a nation that under the Marcos regime took out a ton of money, right? They flee. Who's left? The poor Filipinos to pay for it. Yeah, you got a lot of shoes to show for it, but... or, you know, we can go down the list, the guy from Congo, or...
That's the corruption, you know, the Idi Amin to this world.
But isn't that part of Jubilee to releasing captives?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, you know...
Setting the prisoners free.
I mean, who knows?
One of the questions that I've got is, so our church is participating in Bread for the World's offerings of letters in relationship to this, and What are we doing when mm-hmm. we sign that? Are we participating in a symbolic way? You mentioned the word symbol, and I think there's a lot to that. Are we really entering into the complexities of the conversation by signing and the offering of letters, or are we being symbol to right. living this biblically based and intentional language of forgiveness, mm-hmm. which is in the in religious community, that's not fiscal language usually.
Mm-hmm. Normally a fiduciary responsibility.
Exactly. Yeah. So what are we doing when we sign and participate on an individual basis with this whole movement that Bread for the World has made available to all of us to be a part of?
Some of the material, go ahead, Anne.
Well, I was just saying, I still think part of the trouble with this is I mean, I always come back to theology, but it's this notion of forgiveness. If you look at maybe an example external to this would be the case of maybe incest in a family. How would you look at these four positions? Is forgiveness just saying, well, gee, I'm sorry you did that, come on back in the household and we'll take you back the way you are? I mean, it raises questions for me about how we understand what forgiveness means in the first place. And that's where I think we're not clear sometimes when we sign something, because it's not clear to me in these positions what we mean by forgiveness.
Yeah.
Is it a blanket statement saying there's no consequences? I think that's what you tried to lay out with the case-by-case mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Well, the argument I think in this case is that they've been punished enough.
Right.
Enough's enough.
Exactly.
And the wrong people.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can do that in the same sort of situation. So I think mm-hmm. there's also a question about what happens when radical forgiveness. I like the tornado image. I guess that's provocative to me. Because I don't think... I always wonder why we're so reluctant to really imagine that it might work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's the
so crazy it just might work?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I just think about that sometimes with the sort of radical nature in which Jesus did things. We always take, at least I always take those concepts, and then I start adding qualification after qualification after qualification. And I'm not saying that with the position of the Catholic Church, it's not complicit in the problems, but the radical nature of that sort of open proclamation is that it does begin to sort of free one to say, well, what might happen?
Mm-hmm.
And not that you don't put other things into place and help work with the nations, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that...
Yeah. Although,
well, hey, you rich intellectuals can sit here and argue this subject all night.
Okay.
But I got bills to pay, and I got to go back to work.
No, you don't. You have fish to fillet. Tomas?
Well, I just want to add about this whole forgiveness thing, because I think this is half of it. Us forgiving people who can't pay their debts. I mean, I have a hard time looking at these people as evildoers.
Right.
I mean, the flip side of this is that we need to be forgiven. I mean, just look at Africa. I mean, we need to be forgiven for raping that country and causing these countries to go into debt in the first place. I mean, how many millions of black Africans died in the slave trade and decimated that whole continent at one point? And how many countries were drawn up and parceled out to European conquerors? I mean, we have to be forgiven for that. And maybe this is our forgiveness back. I don't know that it...
This is our act of repentance.
Yeah, or something. I mean, it's not that these people are irresponsible. It's that they shouldn't be dead in the first place. You got to have a historical view of why these folks are in debt. I mean, Latin America has to have similar history to it in terms of conquering a whole continent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to, Mary raised a question about, you know, what are we doing when we support the Bread for the World offering of letters, and not to let that hang. I've been working for the offering of letters also, and I think it's one of the very concrete Christian acts we can make in this, what's in is truly a very complex issue. But the legislation being supported is fundamentally a forgiveness, but it does pay some homage, Jake's gone now, some language is in the bill about debt forgiveness being related to expenditures for social development in countries, education and health. Now, how much teeth can really be applied there, but I think it's got the right direction. And if, you know, as I think we can develop our theological perspective on debt, but if we're actually going to get concretely something to happen, we do need legislation. And I think that there is actually some hope of a bill going somewhere this year. So I think it's a very wide open Christian, biblically based kind of action to take. So I think you can feel good about doing it and promoting others to participate.
Yeah. I'll get to you guys in just a sec. When Jake was talking about this Jubilee 2000 being a big international movement, it is. And when the G8, which are the
70 countries or something.
Say it again.
Something like 70 countries have Jubilee groups.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a big international movement. But when the G8, which is the leaders of the basically the free industrialized nations of the world. They meet, I don't know how often, but I think they met 2 years ago to discuss the debt issue. Supporters of this movement circled the building that they were living in, and there were like 40,000 people that circled this building. And when it was over with, it was disappointing, because when the G8 representatives came out, they had not reached any consensus on how to approach debt relief or debt restructuring or debt forgiveness. 2 years later, this movement had such an impact in raising the amount of public discourse about the issue of debt that they met again in Cologne, Germany, and 80,000 people ringed the city that they were in hand to hand. And when those representatives from the G8 came, 7 of the 8 came to the meeting with debt restructuring or debt forgiveness plans. So it just shows how symbolic action, mobilization, commitment, you know, we can all admit it's complicated, but fundamentally, what's our motivation? Our motivation is the liberation of people that are poor, and they're tired of being poor, and they shouldn't be poor. So,
and we shouldn't shy away from symbolic action and call it just symbol.
Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That is in itself some of its power.
Yeah, well,
or shy away because the issue is complex.
Yeah.
But, you know, so you fellows had both of you had comments.
I'm from one of the poorest countries in this world, which is Tanzania. And it's not fun living in such a economic depression, I would say. Paying debt, I'm taking an example of Tanzania, my country. My father, me, my sons, my daughters, and my grandchildren are going to be paying these debts, and they will never, no generation is going to be able to repay the debt. I mean, this debt is going to go on and on and on. And I'll give you an example. In the 70s, okay, go back. When the loan is issued, you are supposed to pay. How do you pay? You have to have a means of production where you have to generate money to pay it. Okay. I'll give you an example of the basis. The debt in the 70s, where the Tanzanian debt was based on how they were going to be paying that debt, was the cotton from Tanzania on the market had a very good price. okay? They were comparing it with a barrel of cotton in the 70s, one barrel of cotton would have bought a Swiss watch. One Swiss watch, equivalent to a price of a barrel. 10 years later, 10 barrels of cotton was buying one Swiss watch. Which means every dollar that you are going, you are paying in
in debt relief.
In debt, right? Now, 10 years later, you have to work 10 times harder to be able to pay that. And now, if that becomes a trend, 20 years later, you have to work 20 times harder to be able to pay that $1. Which I don't see that impact. And the reason of price of cotton from Tanzania falling on the world market, I don't know if there is an expert on that from that end. I don't know the reason why cotton from different world is better than the cotton in that world, which was is superior than the other. Another example, the Germans issued a loan to Tanzania to build a canvas mill, a canvas factory. Okay, strings were attached. We are going to provide management of the factory. Okay, that's good. We are going to provide the market where the product will be sold on the world market. Fine, okay. So they built the factory and it started working. And then the management of the factory didn't behave the way the local government thought this was normal behavior. Okay, so there was separation there. They didn't work together. So the Germans decided to quit. They left. They left with management. They left with market. So the product didn't have market to sell. Now, when are you going to generate money from to take that debt?
I think there's another half to the question that needs to be looked at as well. That's what about the future of loans to these countries? I would much rather see our government approach it from the basis that they do grants. And instead of looking at loan situations, just like the German situation, if we determine it's that worthwhile to support a country in that way, give them the money. You might want to tie some strings attached to purpose and intent, etc. But you know, look at the amount we give away to study cows that belch, so we know how much methane they give off. I'd much rather see us do something like that to foreign countries than some of the ridiculous things we do.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why debt forgiveness for these highly indebted poor countries has been on the back burner is because while it is true that we live in a global marketplace, and if the, you know, something goes bad in Indonesia, it can have ramifications elsewhere, the reality is that the vast majority of international aid and private investment is going to about between 6 and 10 developing countries, and then the rest get almost nothing. And so if all hell breaks loose in sub-Saharan Africa, because of rampant poverty and ill health brought on and exacerbated by debt relief or debt payments, you know, it doesn't affect, frankly, the rich. And it doesn't change the stock market. It doesn't, you know, it just doesn't affect us. And that's the sad thing about this, and that's why it's taken religious communities to bring attention to this, because otherwise people just weren't really caring about it. And I agree. I mean, I think it's a shame that these loans were initiated. Maybe you know the history of this. Part of it is the petrodollars being recycled back when OPEC started controlling the oil supply, and OPEC nations wound up having a lot of cash. And they didn't want to stick it under their mattress, so they sent it to Chase Manhattan in New York, or they sent it to the Swiss banks or whatever. And then they got all this cash, but what are we going to do with it? Well, what do banks do with cash? They loan it. Who needed money in the 70s? Developing countries. And so a lot of these loans were made with the best of intentions for good, you know, people felt good about themselves, you know, these countries need money, we've got it, we can give them a decent interest rate, it's not going to be an exorbitant rate. And they got into it, and a lot of deals were made that probably shouldn't have been made, not enough
due diligence,
whatever that word is, yeah. And then in the end, you know, then when they can't pay, then the debts get restructured. So, okay, you know, you don't owe it on 1980, you owe it 1995. You can spread it out over those years, but in the end, you're not paying off any of the principal, and you just keep sending the money out of the country, and it's more than it's coming in, and it's just making you poor. It's just like when they took the copper out or the manganese out or whatever, your people out. So it's, you know, enough is enough, is what some folks are saying.
I think dependency theorists have a good take on all this.
What did you call it?
Dependency theorists. They originate in Latin America. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of the liberation theology people associate with it too. But basically they see the world organized around international trade, where you have a core country and then you have the periphery. The periphery countries, which would be the lesser developed countries, are providing the core country with cheap raw materials, and then that's value added in the core country and sold back at higher prices. And that is one of the strongest arguments for the lesser developed countries to say that, look, we have more than paid for this loan already, you know, forgive it.
Mm-hmm. But I think the terms of trade argument about like the Swiss watch and the
The whole international system is built to enforce and reinforce this dependence from the core to the periphery, and things like foreign aid, loans, things like the Green Revolution, for example, in the 1970s, a lot of these countries, let's say Mexico, would buy seeds from Northrop King or Cargill or something, and they need Dow chemicals to grow. I mean, that's another dependency there. You need to, you know, international harvester machines to harvest and so forth.
Agribusiness approach. So, yeah.
I think they have a good perspective on this, and it's completely different than the World Bank. And the World Bank says what you have to do is grow your economy and invest in these sectors. You need capital to do that.
Now, don't think on the World Bank. They just got religion. They're now getting big into micro-enterprise.
Yeah, they are, actually. As much as they can. Let's. We need to wrap this up. We went later than normal. There are some folks that haven't said anything yet, and if you have something you'd like to say, let's make sure we hear from you before we kind of bring the evening to a close. Any last kind of remarks that you'd like to offer?
I just think of the term power. Somebody's got to be the most powerful and in control and keep their thumbs down on others. And I think this is a power issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, forgiveness is powerful. Mm-hmm. I mean,
I just want to say that I agree with what Tom was saying earlier. And I came in late, so I missed the beginning of the, or most of the whole discussion in the forum. But anyway, that it's not just, I don't like seeing it as we're forgiving them, because we need to be forgiven for a lot. And I just took a class last quarter on politics in Latin America, and just going over the histories of our interventions and School of the Americas, the Jack Nelson Hall that I was talking about, just so many things that we've done. Mm-hmm. It's nice to see it. I like the idea of seeing it both ways. Mm-hmm. So that we're looking for some kind of forgiveness too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. All right. Well, thanks. for coming. Tom, did you have
a... Well, one thing that we didn't talk about, I don't know how this can come out later on or some other time, but we didn't really talk about how do we talk about this issue. You alluded to it, that as people living in the number one debtor nation in the world, I mean, as though this isn't our problem.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we're saddling our grandchildren with this $5 trillion debt.
I mean, the 40 countries together probably doesn't equal that, does it? The 40...
Oh, God, no, no, it's 220 billion. It's a pittance.
220 billion versus 5 trillion. I mean, we're talking about...
But they have to pay it in dollars, whereas our debt is in dollars, and that's the currency we have.
And, give it
and it's paper. Yeah, but it's a lot of that paper sold overseas. If folks in Japan tomorrow decide to quit buying American debt, we're in deep doo-doo.
But still, the majority of our debt, the vast majority of our debt is owned,
within
owned
the country.
By us. Mm-hmm. I mean,
U.S. savings.
By our
every savings fund.
Pension funds and
sure.
And others. So it's,
but a lot of, an increasing share of it is offshore. Not owned within the U.S.
As well as our properties.
Yeah. Yeah. Although Japan's licking its wounds for buying, what was it, the Rockefeller Center? And for buying...
Some big ones in downtown Seattle right now.
Oh, is that right? Well, that's true. I don't know about here, so... Well, let's bring it to a close. Thanks for coming, the few, the faithful. It was an interesting conversation. The purpose of forums at Holden isn't to reach consensus. We're not supposed to, we have no illusions of trying to reach agreement across all of our differences, but rather to just have honest and free conversation and learn from each other and challenge each other. So thanks for a good evening and wish you well.